from what I saw.
Growing outrage.
They treat you like a dog.
Horseback blockade at the border.
America, this is your litmus test of humanity and empathy.
Do not deport another person back to Haiti.
Hitting close to home.
I came back with at least 8 to 10 people that were released.
The state should be promoting good health, and vaccination isn't the only path to that.
Florida's new Surgeon General.
We're done with fear.
No fan of mask mandates or vaccine passports.
Quarantining healthy students is incredibly damaging.
And I'm already throwing my kid in a lion's den.
And the battle over boosters.
Yeah, these people are going to be protected and the booster is going to likely help them.
There's nothing special about them compared to any other preventive measure.
And the dispute over vaccination rates.
And when we surpassed 100%, I realized there was a data problem.
It's just not true. It's just not true.
It's all live this week in South Florida.
Good morning. Glad you could join us. I'm Michael Putney.
I'm Glenna Milberg. The border at Del Rio is reopened. The migrant encampment is gone. The outrage and confusion in South Florida is fresh and it is strong.
About 2,000 of the Haitian migrants from Del Rio are now back in Haiti. More than 12,000 have been released provisionally into the U.S. They will go before immigration judges. And 5,000 are being detained by ICE, which will screen them. No doubt many of them will be repatriated. That's the fancy way of saying they will be sent back to a country they don't know and which is in political and social turmoil.
South Florida is home to the nation's largest Haitian community. This is very much a local story, as is the confusing state of U.S. immigration, especially during COVID. Congresswoman Frederica Wilson of Miami represents more Haitian Americans than any other member of Congress. She is here with us today. Congresswoman, good morning. Great to have you aboard.
We are glad to see you, Congresswoman. I was there on Friday at the Little Haiti Cultural Center where you made that impassioned statement. You said, "I am pissed." Explain to us what got you so riled up.
When I have the courage to say pissed in public, it means that I am outraged and I can't find any other word to describe what I feel inside, what I feel that is so wrong, that is outrageous. So it pisses me off. And that's what I mean.
Yeah, well, that's language we all understand. But is it the expulsion flights? Is it the treatment of those Haitian migrants who were corralled and whipped by the Border Patrol agents? What specifically has got you so riled up?
I think what has me so riled up is the deportations and that's what started it. And what really put the icing on the cake was to see the horses being used as instruments to corral Black people.
All right, can we break that down a little bit, Congresswoman? Two things. Let's take the deportations first. DHS Secretary Mayorkas, when he came to Del Rio earlier in the week, he sent what we all got was a very clear message, the talking point. The message was, do not come. The borders are closed. You will be deported. You will be sent back. You will not be successful. He said that over and over again. Of the 15,000 people in that encampment, mostly Haitians, three quarters of them were successful. They are in the United States. They are going to make their assignment claims. We'll talk more about like why 2,000 were summarily sent back, but it clearly was successful. Is there a difference between the message and the method?
I think those people who are I think everyone who arrives at the border is supposed to have due process. And those those 12,000 people who are staying in the U.S. and will have the right to asylum, that is correct. Who they have expelled are single Black men, basically. There were few families, but single Black men they expelled. And the people who decided that they would voluntarily go back to Mexico, most of these people were in Mexico from the beginning. See, there was an encampment of Haitians in Mexico for years who were part of the group that rushed the border. All of these people did not come from Chile and Brazil. There were people already in Mexico, and very few of them actually came from Haiti after the earthquake. So my concern right now, Glenna, we have a cottage industry that has evolved around the Haitians in Chile and Brazil. And these cartels are actually spreading misinformation to the Haitian population, where they all live in Chile, Brazil, and other countries, and saying to them, the border is open. It's time to move. And they are extorting millions of dollars from these people. They come on a voyage that is ruthless, through jungles, on some by train, in big vans. Many die. They told me they passed dead bodies on the road. And these people are making money. So I have called out to the Judiciary Committee in Congress to investigate these people who are actually making money from Haitian immigrants.
We have evidence that you are exactly right. We spoke with some of those Haitians who were permitted to come and state their asylum claims, who told us that they were smuggled. They paid, one man told us, $7,000 by someone who said, it's time, you will be successful. So in this issue that's just mired in political rhetoric, really the policies of immigration have remained fairly static over the last 2, 4, 6 years. So what now, and you mentioned a couple of things, if it is a misinformation and a disinformation campaign in other countries, where is the bipartisan look at how to address that problem?
Well, we have within the soft, what I call the family infrastructure bill, the soft infrastructure bill, immigration reform. And if we are able to pass that bill, that is something that the Senate, we know, is going to strip out of the package. We already know that because they've said that. So it will probably have to be a separate bill, which we've been trying to pass for so many years. But it speaks to that. It speaks to these cartels. These are people, these are the same gangsters who used to bring in drugs using the same route. And we were able to sort of conform that. Yeah. So now they're bringing human beings on the same route. It's, let me say this to you. It is 4,000 miles from Brazil to the border.
Yeah.
That's how far they come.
It's a terrible a journey of misery and violence, and everybody who makes the journey pays a terrible price. Congresswoman, as you well know, a diplomat named Daniel Foote, who was appointed special envoy for Haiti, he was going to be the administration's point man. He was going to be the champion for Haiti. And this week he resigned because he said that he could not be associated with an inhumane immigration policy. So who's going to be the point man for Haiti now in the Biden administration? There's a picture of Mr. Foote.
Well, we will have to find another envoy. This was something that I championed along with Commissioner Marnstein, our county commissioner here. And we'll just have to find someone else. We tried to get him, you know, I didn't think he was going to resign after speaking with him. He said he was, but I, you know, tried to speak with him about not resigning. His number one issue is Haiti. See, he's the envoy for Haiti. We were all week looking at the border. and we forgot about Haiti. So now let's look at Haiti. Haiti is in turmoil. He was appointed to be the envoy to change that. The first thing he wanted to do was to secure Haiti. And in order to do that, there has to be boots on the ground.
Well, he wanted, did he not recommend U.S. military go into Haiti? And the Biden administration said no.
And the administration said no because the people in the United States, the diaspora, do not want that. So they called the White House. The think tanks bombard the White House and they say, we do not want any occupation of our nation by the United States in Haiti. Because we have been through that. We have had the United Nations here. They brought cholera. They impregnated our women. We don't want that. But that's not what Mr. Foote was looking for. He was not looking for people to come and occupy it and stay for 15 years. He was looking for them to come and secure the country and train the Haitian police force and the Haitian army on how to protect their own country.
Congresswoman,
you cannot, there's nothing you can do with Haiti until you secure it.
Yeah, to your point, later in this program, we have the Consul General from Haiti at the to Miami, who will be live with us on this program as well. But I just want to go back quickly to something that you mentioned earlier in this segment and the treatment of the Haitian migrants by the Border Patrol on horseback. We saw those images that right now nationally made people just kind of open their eyes really wide. A sort of delayed reaction from people in the administration held Border Patrol responsible for what they believe might be wrongdoing. I will tell you, we were there. The photographer and the videographer who took these images also concur. These Border Patrol entities on horseback did not whip anybody. Those were reins that they're carrying, except for their own horses. That's how they control their horses. And were charged with protecting the border, newly bottled up to prevent more people from going to that encampment. And yet, this has just riveted and opened wounds that were pretty on the surface to be reopened on how people are being treated at the border. Have you gotten any clarity on that?
Well, I'm a victim of the Border Patrol myself. I have, for 2 years, was under strict security because of the Border Patrol and because of the way they were treating the children who were in the cages. And I said that they should be arrested, and I began to get calls into my home that they were going to kill me. So the Border Patrol, everybody thinks that the Border Patrol might be Hispanics. The Border Patrol are leftover racist white men who do not like immigrants. And what really made them angry was these were black immigrants.
I'm a little uncomfortable, Congresswoman, with having no one here to refute what is a pretty harsh and serious charge. We appreciate your perspective, certainly, but to call people racist without someone to counteract or provide another side to that, I will just tell you I'm very uncomfortable listening to that.
Well, what they were doing was racist. Are you comfortable with that?
From your perspective, I absolutely respect your perspective.
Everyone is concerned about the reins and the whips. But did you see them actually chasing the people with the horses, threatening to run them down with the horses?
Yes, they absolutely were doing that. Okay. And that was, and I'm just providing you with the information that we got on the ground there, that was their task, to close the border and make sure no one got through. That's how they chose to do that job.
These were people who had gone to Mexico to buy food, to buy certain items, diapers for the Pampers for the children, milk, and they were returning back to the camp.
Yeah.
That's where people were. You saw them with the items in their hands.
Yes.
We
if you don't think that those men on the horse, were riding those horses to intimidate Black people, Black men, Black women, Black children is racist, then I think that. So I'm fine saying it on this channel or any other one.
Congresswoman, we appreciate your candor and also your time this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Next, another view from the border.
A number of people from South Florida jumped on flights to go help the Haitians arriving in Del Rio, and we connect with two of them next.
As Border Patrol and immigration agents work to clear the migrants from that huge camp on the border of Del Rio, a contingent of Haitian American leaders from South Florida flew to Texas to help.
Among them, two North Miami City Council members who are also part of the National Haitian American Elected Officials Network. Councilman Alex Desomey is the current national chair, in fact, of the network. He and North Miami Councilwoman Mary Esti Mervin just got back from the border late this week and join us right there live via Zoom. Great to see you both. Saw you in Del Rio. See you on Zoom.
Good morning. We're very glad you're here. Mary, I spoke with you on Friday. Let me just ask you, you commented that on your flight back from Del Rio from Texas that there were 8 to 10 migrants who had been released by ICE and were being resettled in Miami. Do you know how many ultimately are going to be released? Have any idea, any informed guess?
No, I don't have an informed guess of how many are going to be released. But like I mentioned to you, Michael, on my flight last week, there were about approximately 8 to 10 members or persons, predominantly pregnant women and their husbands, that flew to Fort Lauderdale with me to be united with relatives here in South Florida.
Alex, when we were in Del Rio together, the three of us were standing in a parking lot, and I had mentioned to you, you were telling us you had come to fact find. DHS Secretary Mayorkas was preparing to have a press conference then. Instead of fact-finding, you all found yourself being your own sort of social service agencies and really working on the ground with people being released with nothing. And bus tickets and plane fare, connections to families, hotel rooms. What was wrong with that process? I mean, were the sheer numbers just overwhelming the system?
Good. Well, again, thank you, Michael and Glenna, for having us here today, member of NEON. We went to have a press conference within 24 hours. We were supposed to get back. The Haitian Bridge Alliance, the only Black organization there, invited myself, and I selected some members of the organization to travel with me, including council member Esti May Irving. It was very, very telling and disturbing when we got there. I think I met you at the gas station where the agency that ICE, the Border Patrol folks, dropped people to, they were overwhelmed. They have never experienced something like that, which is understandable. The situation was dire. And once they processed those people, they would drop them at the gas station, I think the Strip gas station, which was also the Greyhound bus station in town. And the leftovers, there would be a Greyhound bus that would come around 6 or 7 o'clock, pick up most of the people. Like 90% of those folks were transported to San Antonio and then eventually to Houston, Texas, et cetera, et cetera. However, there was the 10% that was left back. There was no food, no hotel. The capacity of hotels in the area, because it's a military base, was already preoccupied before this crisis started.
And I want to give our viewers a sense of, this is the immigration process. So are these people who are given, or the people who have been released and processed and are making asylum claims, for the next year, 2 years, maybe 3 years, they'll be going through the process. They are given notices to either report to their local immigration offices or a specific court date. They're left on their own. Is that the process?
that is the process, and we heard that it's been going on for 2 years prior. That's why folks there on the ground didn't really see why we were all getting all, you know, that's something that we have never seen before. But I knew if there was one thing we needed to do as an organization who are asked to come and help, we needed to stop that. And I think by Wednesday of last week, that process stopped. They changed the process, which I told them I would, my organization would step up and we would buy coach buses. We'll make sure we get drivers. We'll rent coach buses and have drivers drive them directly from the center that they are processing to their final destination so that they could eventually reunite with their loved ones. So they told us that would take 2 days to get done. But as of Wednesday of last week, they did change that, and there's no longer no one stopping at the bus stop where they have nowhere to go. So that's a little victory that we're proud of.
Councilwoman Estime Irvine, let me ask you, I'm sure on Friday you heard President Biden. It had taken him 5 days to speak publicly about the situation at the border. But when he did speak, he spoke forcefully. He condemned the way that the Border Patrol agents had treated those migrants in the river, the agents on horseback. Were you satisfied with what he said?
Well, I appreciate the fact that he did address the matter. But as the National Haitian American Elected Official Network, we are asking that he does a little bit more than that, that there is immediate investigation, swift investigation in 30 days, and to report back to us to see what actions will be taken, because obviously that was inhumane. We understand that, you know, they have to control the borders, but still we in America should not be treating anyone that is seeking any type of refuge for very various reason in that matter.
On that note, we're going to take a quick break. We invite you to sit tight right there. We will be back in a few minutes and continue this conversation.
Welcome back. We are in the midst of a conversation with two members of the North Miami City Council, Alex Desaulniers and Mary Estime Irvine. Alex, let me ask you, you know, when you see this huge one, we all saw the pictures of nearly 15,000 people, the individual stories begin to blur. You don't see them as individuals, but both you and Mary spoke with, helped, worked with some of these individuals. Tell us a couple of stories about who these people were and what brought them to the border. What made them take this really desperate, expensive, and dangerous journey?
Michael, it's a great question. And they did it just like any of us who are migrant, well, all of us really, for a better life, for a better opportunity. The America is supposed to be the land of the free. And I think Congresswoman Wilson, I must say, who has been standing with Neon from day one. She called me and she said, what we need, she would be there with us, and she made sure that whatever that we need as an organization, she's there to provide it as our congressperson representing most of the Haitian American in Congress. That picture, what you saw under the bridge, I had an opportunity as I was getting pushed back from DHS into accessing the bridge. And I told Secretary Mayorkas when we spoke this week that our organization is impacted as much as they are, because these are our people who are trying to get here for a better life. And the Congresswoman was correct. There's a lot of miscommunication, but it also started with the department, with Mayorkas's department.
Yes, so, and was, Alex, excuse me, was Secretary Mayorkas empathetic? I mean, when you said that to him, what was his reaction?
Well, we had a private conversation. I'm not going to get into the detail of it, but the gist of the conversation was we as elected officials, the Haitian American elected officials, are not getting access, and the media wasn't getting access. I mean, Glenna was on the ground with us when he had the press conference, and we had the wrong location. So there's a lot that to say about that, and I did share that story with him. And he said he did not know that I was in town. We had that conversation on Thursday. So the fact that there's a, we're not getting access, we cannot confirm what's going on, is third-hand information, information that we are getting. And my members from 17 states, in Arizona, New York, all over Georgia, they are getting pounded by constituents, residents, wanting to know what NEON is doing and what they are doing in terms of members. And I share that with Secretary Mayorkas. So it's important to know that after speaking to several hundreds of migrants that we assisted, and Councilwoman Irvin, my colleague, is correct, most of them, there was a pattern, but we didn't know what was the criteria or if they even have a due process.
That's one of the questions, Alex, that we have been asking as well. And as journalists, we have not gotten those answers either. Just to throw that out there. Mary, in the really short time we have left, I just want to bring up a major concern. And we all watched that encampment. And aside from the squalid conditions, we know that there are, if any, none of those people there have had vaccines, COVID vaccines. None have been tested, and despite the DHS secretary saying there are protocols to do so, the Haitians who were released that we spoke with said that they had not been tested. What are the concerns of thousands of people? You know, this country gives vaccines, sells vaccines, donates vaccines to countries. Why aren't these people being taken care of, and in fact taking care of the people around them as well, with that kind of vaccination or testing?
Thank you for the question. Before we even talk about vaccination, why were they underneath the bridge that long? That shouldn't have been even a condition where someone should have been under the bridge that long. So as the National Haitian American Elected Official Network, one of our asks is that the people that are here, that they are provided the opportunity to be vaccinated if they choose to be, or if they are able to be vaccinated, and to have access to some type of medical, to have medical attention. So we're hoping that this government, outside of the vaccination, provide humanitarian parole. We're hoping that we have stopped deportation. We're hoping that there's a repeal of Title 42. And we're hoping that the administration is now planning to have policies, more U.S. Friendly policies towards the Haitian, and especially Black immigrants in this country. Yeah, there are other immigrants that come here, and they have, they don't go through the struggle that we go through here. So we're just asking that this government, that this president that came, like I've mentioned in our press conference on Thursday, that he came to Little Haiti to say that he would be a friend of Haiti, and we're hoping that he can be a friend to Haiti in this process.
We understand. We were there when he campaigned in Little Haiti, and he made a pledge. I know you're trying to hold him to the promises he made in the campaign. Mary Estime Irvin, thank you. Alex Desomais, both, thank you for being with us today.
So much.
Thank you.
All right, some 2,000 of those from the border are already back in Haiti right now, summarily expelled over the last week.
Haiti's Consul General to South Florida will join us next. Haiti has been in turmoil for a long time, you could say in turmoil, since the massive earthquake in 2010 that killed about 300,000 people.
The recent earthquake last month killed 2,200 people, a crisis then made worse by a tropical storm, and all that occurred during a political crisis following the president's assassination weeks before. Haiti's liaison in South Florida is the consulate, and the Consul General, Stefan Gilles, is with us today from Texas. Stefan, great to have you on the program.
Thank you, Glenna. Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, Mr. Consul General, great to have you. We appreciate it. First of all, let's talk about the migrants who were returned to Haiti so far. 22 flights with approximately 2,000 people. What is happening to them? Are they being helped by your government?
Well, the government is putting in place a task force and put in place a task force to try to help this surge that was coming in. It was unexpected out of nowhere. So we're trying to work together to actually find a way to guide these people and help them find their proper path.
When you say unexpected, there we had intelligence, as we do now, that there were people, thousands of people, staging in South American countries. You heard Congresswoman Frederica Wilson talk about the smuggler network. This was not a super shock, maybe the numbers all of a sudden was, and maybe the encampment was, but certainly the Western Hemisphere knows that this migration is happening. So, Mr. Consul General, you know, Haiti is in a place where it says it cannot absorb people right now. Politically, the crisis is political and it's social and it's economic and it's environmental. So what do you foresee happening?
For starters, I think the people that left Haiti, pretty much, they left Haiti back in 2010. So they didn't just leave Haiti. They left Haiti, they went to different countries. A lot of the people that I've heard speak, they came from Brazil, they came from Chile. So these people are looking for life. They're looking for an opportunity. It's not that they were looking to come to the United States per se, but they were looking for an opportunity because that opportunity changed for them when they were over there and everybody started coming here. So it's an unfortunate situation. The surge came all at once. I've seen people come. I actually met with the CBP yesterday, went under the bridge right by the water, and they were saying that the people were actually being smuggled little by little. And it's something that they can't really control. And for you to have 14,000 people come all at once, a few days apart, and to manage such a situation, realistically, it's if you're not set up for it, then it's impossible. And I actually saw how they were trying to prepare to accommodate these people. But like I said, it's 14,000 people being there all at once, and there's so much you could do when you're hit with a shock like that.
Can you explain to us? I mean, the horrifying assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. And the literal crumbling of the government. The prime minister is in charge, sort of, by what decree, no one is really sure. Explain to us what may be unexplainable. As the consul general, you are the government liaison, you answer to the government. Who are you answering to? Who's in charge?
Well, right now the prime minister is in charge. Before the president was assassinated, he nominated a new prime minister who is currently in charge. So he's the one who's there right now to facilitate the process to get to elections, to nominate a new government or a new president. So he is the one leading the country right now.
Yeah. Mr. Consul General, let me go back to the migrants, the Haitian nationals who've been returned to the country. I know I've spent many reporting trips in Haiti. I know that, you know, the government does its best, and there are all kinds of NGOs that are at work there. In this particular instance, is the American government stepping up and helping your government to give these people money, clothes, transportation, you know, to a place where they can live? I mean, I think we're all very worried about what happens to these people.
Well, I can tell you as of last night, I left Del Rio last night. I went to Houston and I met with Houston Haitians United, which I've worked with before, and the National Association of Christian Churches, who have pretty much, these two are working together closely to and they've helped so many people. They've been sending buses to Del Rio to bring these people back here to Houston. They've been feeding the people, getting them somewhere to sleep, processing the people. Even there's about 34 or 35 people that actually have COVID, and they have a COVID unit in their center. And they also have hotels for these people who have COVID. So, and this is all from their money, from what I understand. And this is why I met with them last night, to see how we can support them and actually find a way to get them whatever they need. They need money, that's for sure. They need food for the people. So many women have kids over there. So you need diapers, you need formulas, baby formulas. So there's so much that's needed, but I don't think, from what I understand, they haven't gotten any help from any local authorities.
You know, you heard, or maybe, I hope, hopefully you heard our segment with the Congresswoman and answering Michael's question about what the U.S. can do long-term. She had said that boots on the ground is not, U.S. boots on the ground is not what Haiti wants. Is that true?
I think Haiti has to find itself, its own self, but there's a fight for struggle, for power. And I think the first thing we need to do within ourselves is get together and make a decision to move forward. Because if there's a continuous fight for power, then as you can tell, this is what led to the assassination of the president, and everybody just wants the power. So at the end of the day, it's we have to find a way to sit together and progress. If it's gonna get, is it gonna get to the point to where the U.S. has to put their boots on the ground to actually help us coordinate ourselves? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, we know that from 1915 to 1934, U.S. Marines occupied the country. We're in the country. It may not be any kind of a solution now. Stéphane Gilles, we really appreciate your time, and Godspeed with your work.
Thanks so much. A fresh round of confusion in fighting COVID 2.0, boosters, vaccination rates, and the first moves by Florida's new Surgeon General.
We will speak with the one and only Dr. Eileen Marty when we come back. Booster shots are now available for millions of Americans, and pharmacies here in South Florida are already giving doses.
But there is still a lot of confusion over this third dose, over the boosters, and over other things COVID-related. And for that, Dr. Eileen Marty from Florida International University joins us now. What, from the forest? Where are you? are you on a hike or something?
You're on your deck, so it looks good. Dr. Marty, welcome.
Green screen.
We really appreciate your time.
So, go ahead.
No, Glenna, go for it.
There is, Michael and I are just sitting here. My question is, why are people confused? And Michael, like, explained, people are saying different things, the CDC and the director and the advisory panel. What do we need to know about boosters? Who gets them and when?
So the bottom line is, right now, it's the people who can get the boosters are people that are 65 years old or older, or 18 to 60, and above, who have the kinds of underlying conditions that make them more likely to need that booster because of those underlying conditions, and individuals whose occupation puts them at high risk of getting severe disease, very high bolus of infection. And likewise, those kinds of individuals, because of their occupation, who are close to individuals who wind up being high risk, again, they need the boosters as well to protect those individuals.
Yeah, well, we're talking about people like you, doctors, healthcare workers, people who are exposed to people who have COVID-19. Dr. Marty, what about people who got the J&J?
Yes, and also, if I were...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
If I were exposed, and then I would expose someone who's very susceptible. So when you're in a high-risk profession where you are likely to, encounter the virus, then you don't want to transmit that to the next patient either.
Of course. So my question now is, for people who got Moderna or J&J, what is their status with another shot?
So are you asking about the J&J vaccine? Because I didn't hear you for a second.
Yes.
There.
Yeah. The J&J, which was obviously a single shot. What do you say to those people who are waiting to understand if they should get a booster?
So that's not going to be a booster. That's going to be a second dose, which is the appropriate thing to do for the J&J. The reason it was done as a one shot is because it was good enough to give you that 70% efficacy, which was over the minimum that we looked at when we were first trying to create these vaccines, and we didn't know where we'd land. But a second dose of the J&J gets you up to that 93% efficacy, very comparable to two shots of Pfizer or two shots of Moderna when they originally were done. So it really is where people need to be. Remember that the J&J vaccine is an adenovirus that's reproduction incompetent, that has on it a piece of the spike from Corona, and that adenovirus 26 modified that way with that particular spike is almost identical to the one that's used in Sputnik by the Russians, but the Russians always gave the second shot, in their case with an adenovirus 5, to bring that efficacy up to 90. So we're just paralleling now by giving a second dose of J&J what the Russians had been doing in the first place.
And the people who got one of those three available shots the first time have to get the same booster from the same company, Pfizer, Moderna, J&J, is that right?
That is currently what's recommended because there's just not enough here in the United States about mixing and matching vaccines. And so the data decisions, and so basing it on using the same is why it's done that way. But everyone is familiar with studies in Spain and in the UK and in Germany and elsewhere showing that mixing and matching can actually work quite well, especially drugs like, vaccines like the AstraZeneca matched with something like Pfizer or Moderna.
See, this is why it's confusing, because you just gave two pieces of information in one answer. So this is why people are confused. Doctor, can we talk about, real quickly, there is kind of a blow up this week about vaccination rates. Miami-Dade is touting 90% vaccinated, which was, wow, you know, I think the state is not even 60% as a whole. Broward and Monroe right behind. But this week, there were parts of the counties that were 100%+ vaccinated, which kind of is not possible. So what is going on with those numbers?
Right, and over 2,700% vaccinated with the zip code of the airport. What we're looking at is people who are not resident getting their vaccine here, and a very large percentage of those individuals claiming a zip code that belongs to Miami-Dade. And therefore, our numbers are incorrect in terms of what are the percent of our residents that are actually vaccinated.
And is that important information? I mean, how would that dictate people's behavior, knowing that or not?
Right, because we want to have our community have upwards of 80, ideally over 90% of us fully vaccinated, and then we could really expect to have an easing of transmission down to something that's no longer a high risk. That would be ideal. That's what we want. But we're not really there. So the true numbers are much lower than that, and we just don't have the correct data input to give back the correct output. So our numerators are off. Our denominators are based on the census data.
All right, Dr. Eileen Marty, we always value your expertise and time. Thank you very much. You know, stay well.
Thanks, doctor. And if you are still confused, you are not alone. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. As always, we thank you. We are grateful that you spent this hour with us. And remember, for all the news all the time, we are online 24/7 at local10.com.
And remember, as always, stay informed. Get involved. Have a great Sunday.